I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be talking about a very important but often under-discussed subject, specifically influence peddling by foreign lobbies and the defense industry in Washington, D.C., and how it relates to the problem of what our guest calls the military-industrial congressional think tank complex. The guest in question is Ben Freeman of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative at the Center for International Policy. In this conversation, we'll discuss lobbying efforts by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Taiwan, and Israel, among others, as well as the deep-pocketed defense contractors funding some of the nation's most prestigious think tanks. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views, and now on to the conversation with Ben Freeman of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative at the Center for International Policy. Welcome to Parallax Views. Ben Freeman of the Center for International Policy, and specifically the director of the Center for International Policy's Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, JG. How are you?
Good, good. And I'm really glad we could finally have you on because there's a lot of talk about foreign influence in the past few years. A lot of Democrats have talked about Russia, and I think now I hear a lot of Republicans talking about China. I've even heard a few Republicans call Joe Biden Beijing Biden. I guess that's the name they're trying to use for him. But
I hadn't heard that. Oh, man.
There's some really serious issues when it comes to foreign influence. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the mainstream sort of coverage of this idea of foreign influence, because sometimes I think it can get, at times it can get tabloid, and maybe what you're doing with the Foreign Policy Transparency Initiative.
Yeah, absolutely. I think really the issue goes back to the 2016 election and Russian interference in the 2016 election, because frankly, before that, nobody gave much of a hoot about foreign influence. I unfortunately know this personally all too well because I wrote a book about foreign influence before the 2016 election that was not a New York Times bestseller. In fact, I'm not sure if my mom and dad still have read it. Which is all to say that there was this issue of foreign influence before, but it just wasn't getting the press, the media, the policymaker attention before 2016 really brought it to the headlines. And then, of course, with 2016, we hear about these Russian operatives, them being charged with violating this thing called the Foreign Agents Registration Act, or FARA. And then we hear about all these people in Trump world, from Michael Flynn to Paul Manafort and others, being charged with violating FARA as well. And so FARA kind of goes from being this sort of obscure thing that, you know, people didn't really follow, even the people that should follow it, people that should be registered under it, they weren't registering. The Department of Justice wasn't prosecuting them for not registering. And so it was this kind of toothless law. It goes from that, but then after the 2016 election, it goes to this, you know, kind of real bear with some teeth. People start paying attention to it again. DOJ starts prosecuting people again for violating it. And if you listen to some of the lawyers who do some of this work, they called it a FARA feeding frenzy, based on the number of people who were being indicted for violating FARA or who were just being asked to register under FARA. And all of that is well and good. And it's good that we pay attention to foreign influence because of elections. But what I always try to remind people of is America's enemies, they're not waiting for an election. They're not waiting for every 4 years to garner some influence on America. They're doing it every single day. And it doesn't take any special election or any big event for it to happen. Every single day, America's adversaries and our allies in some cases are doing work to try and shape U.S. foreign policy. It's a $500 million industry every year in most countries in the world. Have lobbyists working for them right now in America. More than half of the countries in the world do. And so that's where I come in. In my program specifically, we're focused on really those other 364 days of the year that aren't called Election Day, and looking at that day-to-day influence, looking at those day-to-day lobbying operations, in trying to bring greater transparency for all the different ways that these foreign powers are trying to shape U.S. foreign policy.
So this is going to sound maybe like a dumb question, and I hope it isn't, but...
No dumb question.
There are some people I know that will respond to any talk of foreign lobbies and foreign influence and think, oh, those are just xenophobic conspiracy theories. How do you respond to people like that? Because I think they're off base when they say that. I think that's a smear.
I mean, we hear that a lot in this space. We hear, you know, if you're calling somebody, you know, a foreign agent, that you know that's automatically xenophobic. And I think there are some people who genuinely they use FARA and they use the term foreign agent. They do use it in a xenophobic way or for xenophobic motivations. But I don't think that's really true of a lot of good foreign influence analysis out there. Because at the end of the day, for me, especially in my program, it's all about the transparency of it. It doesn't matter which country it is. If there's a country out there that's trying to influence U.S. foreign policy, you know, I don't care who it is. I don't care if it's Saudi Arabia, which is where we started in one of our reports. And then recently we've done reports on some of America's biggest allies, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. And nobody would look at those countries and say, like, oh, you know, the arch nemesis, you know, our great enemy, you know, Seoul. But the reason we look at countries like that is because even our allies, even countries that, you know, might not be in the news, they can influence U.S. foreign policy just as much as a Russia or China can. And in fact, they can do it in even stronger ways in some cases. I think Israel is another good example of this. You know, one of America's oldest allies and what some would say staunchest allies. The Israel lobby influences U.S. foreign policy every single day. And we're really seeing it come to a head now. And I don't think there's inherently anything xenophobic about saying the American public has a right to know more about what the lobbyists for these countries are up to.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've noticed that there are some people that will talk almost exclusively about AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. And then there's other people that are very staunchly pro-Israel that will only talk about Saudi lobbying. And I'm like, well, you know, both things can kind of be true.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with that. And along those exact same lines, one of the kickers for me in my program was a few years ago, you know, we put out this report on the Saudi lobby just after Jamal Khashoggi was murdered. And so, you know, we got a lot of press and we got a lot of attention. We brought a lot of eyeballs on the Saudi lobby. And I, of course, was accused of being a Qatari agent. And everybody thought, oh, you're going after the Saudis, therefore you must be be with the Qataris. You must be with their rival. But then I put out a report on the Qatar lobby. And then people said, it looks like you're a Saudi agent. You know, the Saudis must be paying you now. So depending on what time you ask people about me and the work I'm doing, I'm whatever other country's agent. When it turns out at the end of the day, I'm not working for any of them. I'm really just working for the American people and trying to bring more transparency to all of this crazy lobbying that's going on.
When it comes to this kind of lobbying, do certain lobbies end up trying to influence specific political parties more than others? Like, for instance, I've heard that, the Saudi lobby may try to influence the Republicans a bit more, and the Qataris may influence the Democrats a bit more, try to. Is there any truth to that, or, just broader strokes on that? Is there truth to that?
Yeah, that's a great question. There is a little bit of truth to that. We do see a little bit more of a Republican lean to the Saudis focus. For example, recently, the Saudis have been spending a lot of time in kind of flyover states in middle America. But it also turns out a lot of the states they're spending time in are Republican senators' states. And they're specifically trying to influence those senators to basically stay on board with them. As long as the filibuster stays in place, those senators really help to protect the Saudis against any measures that might go through Congress that would hurt them. And for the Qataris, too, historically, we've seen that with them, that they tend to work with Democrats more. But with the Qataris, I think that really shifted now. And the Qataris, I think, have a very balanced influence operation after Trump came into power. Because basically what happened is Trump comes into power and he's sort of this foreign policy neophyte, doesn't know much about it. And so the Saudi lobby and Prince Mohammed bin Salman specifically swoops in and gets really tight and chummy with the Trump White House really early, or helps to organize that initial trip of Trump to Saudi Arabia. And then, not surprisingly, right after that, Saudi Arabia announces the blockade of Qatar. So Qatar at the time really didn't have a lot of influence on the Republican side. They had some, and they had plenty on the Democratic side. But what they did after that, in the years since that happened, is they really shored up their operations on the Republican side. They hired some people in Trump land, some former campaign staff that worked for Trump, and really shored it up there. And so really what we're seeing now with the Qataris, and really to a lesser extent with the Saudis still have a lot of influence on the Democratic side of the aisle, too. And what I was trying to remind people in my reports is that foreign influence is one of the few issues in Washington politics that's still bipartisan. You've got former Democrats, former Republicans working on behalf of these foreign governments, and they're contacting their former colleagues on both sides of the aisle, too. It doesn't really matter. These foreign powers are just looking to influence whoever can get the job done for them.
So in terms of the history, for people that may not have a background, where would you take the history of foreign influence peddling in the U.S. back to? And also, in case people are unfamiliar with FARA, could you describe that a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. This is, as a former professor, this is one of my favorite questions. We get to talk about the history of all this cool stuff. The Foreign Agents Registration Act, it actually goes back to Hitler in Nazi Germany. Prior to World War II, Hitler's Germany had sent agents here to the U.S. to try and drum up sympathy for Nazi Germany, to get the U.S. on their side in what would ultimately be World War II, or at the very least to keep the U.S. on the sidelines of World War II. Because I think at the time Hitler was sort of conscious of the sleeping giant that was the U.S. So he sends all these agents over here, and they're sort of running amok, drumming up support here, trying to appeal to white nationalist movements that were already here in the U.S. And Congress, fortunately, takes notice of this. And they, as Congress does on many issues, they create a commission to look into this in the mid-1930s. They ultimately came to the conclusion that this was a serious problem, and they recommended what ultimately became the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which was first passed in 1938. Now, when it was initially passed, it was really, really focused exclusively on the these propagandists, folks who were coming into the U.S., spreading this Nazi propaganda, trying to drum up this Nazi sympathy with their propaganda. And so it was focused on being a transparency statute that disclosed folks who were doing that. So if you were a German agent working here on behalf of the German government, and you were doing that type of stuff, you would have to register with the U.S. government that you were doing it, and just a basic disclosure of the activities you were doing. We don't really get what we have now with FARA until decades later, actually. And this part of it goes back to the communists, and specifically to Cuba. Shortly after the Cuban Missile Crisis takes place, actually prior to that, when we have the U.S. embargo of Cuba, prior to that, the U.S. was getting most of its sugar from Cuba. Cuba was the number one supplier of sugar to the U.S. So when the U.S. starts the Cuba embargo, then there's this void, and we had a sugar quota system at the time. And so to fill that void, all of these other sugar-producing countries in the Caribbean and in Central and South America, they then hire lobbyists. They go into outright bribery. They do all sorts of crazy stuff to try and get their share of those sugar quotas. They're doing stuff that would make Jack Abramoff blush, man. This is just the Wild West of lobbying. But fortunately, folks in Congress took notice of this, and they said, man, we can't let this happen again. We got to reform FARA to not just focus on propaganda, to focus on these foreign lobbyists too. And so then we get a bunch of revisions there that really leave FARA kind of in the place it is today, where it both tackles the propaganda that's coming in from foreign powers, and it tackles the lobbyists who are working on behalf of those foreign powers. In both cases, FARA in and of itself doesn't say that you can't say anything. The statute doesn't prohibit any speech. It doesn't say you can say this and you can't say that. All it requires is transparency about what you're doing, what you're saying, and who you're meeting with, and who those specific agents are.
So in other words, if someone is registered as a foreign agent, it doesn't mean that they can't keep up with their efforts necessarily. It's just that they have to be transparent about that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Registering under FARA, it doesn't actually prohibit you from doing anything in and of itself. Now, of course, the other laws about espionage and everything, those types of activities, those are all still applicable. But just registering under FARA, it doesn't change anything about what you do. Plenty of organizations are registered under FARA, and they continue to do exactly what they were doing before. It's just full transparency with the American public now.
So it's interesting. Sometimes when I have these conversations about foreign influence, I'll mention something like, say, this is a good one. Recently, I think Joe Biden on Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day essentially formally, said it was a genocide, yeah. Armenian genocide. And for years, we didn't have that. I think it was 104 years. And I think that was in part due to the efforts of the Turkish lobby. But for some reason, I still get responses like, well, how does this affect me as an American? Like, that's great that they now recognize it. And it's sad that the Turkish lobby didn't want this recognized. But how does foreign lobbying influence me as an American? Do we have any examples where it directly affects us?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I mean, it's a fair question, frankly. In that case, people may not care about the Armenian genocide. I certainly do. As a fan of human rights around the world, I think it's important that we recognize what happened there.
And likewise.
Yeah, I'm sure. And Because I, for, you know, for me, an incident like that, recognizing that this atrocity happened, it helps us to prevent it from happening again. And potentially things are, maybe not the best in the U.S. right now. You know, if we call out political problems abroad, I think we'll do a better job of identifying political problems at home and preventing those types of things from happening and from history repeating itself. But in addition to that, even if you don't buy it and you say, you know, Freeman, I don't care about that human rights stuff abroad. You know, I'm worried about me and my pocketbook and the bottom line here. One example I will give you is from early in the pandemic. I don't know if you or your viewers remember this, but Russia and Saudi Arabia got in this huge tiff about oil prices. And, you know, it was driving the price of oil just like way down. I mean, at one point, I don't quite understand oil futures, but oil futures were negative, which I assume meant like we would all get a barrel of oil just like for free. But it just really crushed the oil market. And that affected a lot of Americans in oil producing states. You know, if you were somebody who was working at any of our major energy companies, you're watching this fiasco happen between Saudi Arabia and Russia, and you're just going like, what the hell? Like, are we going to lay off people? You know, what's this going to mean for people's paychecks? What you probably didn't see at that time was the Saudi lobby was going, hey, you know, making huge hay over this in Congress in their PR operations to basically try and convince folks that it wasn't their fault. This is all Russia. And meanwhile, we know it was, you know, it took two to tango, and it was very much the Saudis' fault too. But the U.S. was very slow to act on this because of the entrenched Saudi lobby in all the efforts they were doing to sort of get us to shut up about it. And meanwhile, you know, Americans across the country and some of these oil and gas companies were in serious jeopardy of, you know, maybe being furloughed or, you know, maybe missing a paycheck or two. So that to me is one of those perfect cases where there's sometimes when these countries are engaging in this lobbying that, you know, it can really mean paychecks for the average American.
So I don't want to change subjects too much, but before I had you on the show, I was doing my research and I found out that you actually have written about the MIC, and people are going to say, oh, military industrial complex. Yeah. But you used the term military industrial congressional complex. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that, because I think it's a very important point to make, to put congressional in there.
Yeah.
Because things have evolved so much since the days of the Eisenhower farewell speech. And maybe after explaining that, you can address how this ties into issues like foreign interest lobbying.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll warn you that I also want to add two T's on the end of it too. I want it to be the MICCTT, and that's for think tank, because they play an immense role in this too. But specifically to Congress, there's the way we conceive of the military-industrial complex when we think about the entrenched relationship between the Department of Defense and defense contractors now. The defense industry in the U.S. has become one of the largest industries in the U.S. And when we talk about American manufacturing, and now American manufacturing may be on the decline in many sectors, but there's one where American manufacturing is far and away ahead of the rest of the world. And that's for military equipment. We are by far the largest arms dealer in the world. It's not even close. We give more arms to more countries than any other country does. And the Department of Defense budget, which just recently Biden just came out with his new defense budget, which perhaps unsurprisingly to those of us who pay attention to these things, was even more than Trump's last defense budget. So it doesn't matter if it's a Republican or Democrat, the defense budget just keeps going up. A key to that, a key to understanding that budget is that more than half of that $715 billion is not going to go to the troops. It's going to go to the defense contractors who are building military equipment, who are serving as service contractors, providing everything from lunches to soldiers on the ground in some cases. They're the folks who will make sure that when the U.S. technically pulls out of Afghanistan, we don't really pull out because we'll still have some contractors on the ground there. And in some cases, some heavily armed contractors on the ground there. So in some cases, these are folks who are, you know, literally in the line of fire in doing a lot of work that U.S. soldiers once did. So that's the military industrial complex. Where Congress plays in is part of the military industrial complex's influence operation. Now, if Congress wasn't dependent on lobbying donations specifically, if they weren't dependent on that, then I don't think the military industrial complex, as we know it, would exist to the scale it does, at least. But what military contractors do, they donate heavily to most members of Congress, but specifically to members of Congress on the key committees for them. And that's the Armed Services Committees and the Defense Appropriations Committees, the folks who are responsible for setting the DoD budget. And we can quantify exactly how many millions of dollars are flowing from these contractors to these members of Congress. And then we can triangulate the votes of those same members of Congress voting for the weapon systems for those very same weapons manufacturers. And across the board, in many cases, they're voting for more and more money for weapon systems that just don't work, whether it's the F-35, the Joint Strike Fighter, that's, you know, more than 20 years in development and still can't function properly, or planes like the F-22, the Littoral Combat Ship. Then the list could just go on and on here. And there's a reason we keep throwing good money after bad with these programs, and that's this military industrial congressional complex ecosystem. And I promise you, JG, and I know I'm going off for a bit here, but I promise you that I would talk about the TT at the end too, which I think is even less understood than the congressional part of this web. And the TT is for think tanks. And a lot of people don't realize this when they're listening to, you know, an expert talk on NPR, or you know they see that defense analyst on CNN or Fox News or wherever they're getting their news. That person in a lot of cases is working at a think tank, and they might hear names like Heritage Foundation, Brookings Institution, Center for American Progress. Then they might see those names and think nothing of it. But behind all of those think tanks I just mentioned is defense contractor funding. And those very same defense contractors who U.S. taxpayers are giving now more than $300 billion a year to, they're turning around and using that money to help pay for members of Congress campaigns, and also to pay to keep the lights on at a number of D.C. think tanks around Washington, D.C. And now, not surprisingly, many of those same think tanks will get on national media and talk about the need for increasing defense spending, or the need for the Joint Strike Fighter, the need for the Littoral Combat Ship, you know, why we need to keep going down these absurd paths. And the reason is very clear in some of these cases. If they don't say these things, then the money stops coming in from defense contractors and they have to shut down their think tanks. And so I spend a lot of time trying to educate folks about the funding behind a lot of the experts that they're hearing and the funding behind a lot of these think tanks, both coming from these big defense contractors and coming from foreign governments too. And foreign governments, in many cases, this is another overlap too. In a lot of cases, when we're talking about arms sales abroad, when Saudi Arabia gets a big multi-billion-dollar arms sale, they're getting this equipment that Lockheed Martin, you know, Raytheon, Boeing are selling them. And so their lobbyists, in many cases, are one and the same. The same lobbyist who's representing Lockheed Martin is the same lobbyist who's representing Saudi Arabia, who can then go into the same member of Congress and lobby for an arms sale that benefits both of their clients. So the system is also absurdly connected that I think our conceptions of the military-industrial complex need to be vastly expanded and updated for this insane 21st century environment that we live in.
when we talk about the defense industry funding of think tanks, I just want to clarify this. How much money are we talking about? Because I've talked to different people off the record about this, and you know, I've been told that the amount of money is usually, you know, really wild.
Yeah. I love this question. And actually, this was a question that we had, and we had never seen a comprehensive study on this. So what we did, we put out a report on foreign government funding of think tanks. And then, of course, you know, the people were like, I love the report. Now do defense contractors. And I'm just like, oh, God, man, that report was a lot. But I loved it because it was a question as a defense budget analyst myself for 10 years now. It's a question I always wondered, you know, what's the scale of this? And so we did it. We took a look at just the top 50 think tanks in the U.S. And we just went and looked back for 5 years. And just with that tiny little sample, and not all think tanks disclose their funders, but just from that tiny little sample, we found over $1 billion in think tank funding that we could trace directly back to defense contractors in the Department of Defense. So it's an extraordinary amount of money. And depending on the think tank that you're talking about, you know, some get far more than others. And I think a general good rule of thumb, if a think tank has anything like national security or security or defense in its name, chances are that think tank gets a lot more money than the others do.
And this also ties into a report you co-wrote with Eli Clifton recently, entitled Restoring Trust in the Think Tank Sector. That's from the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. And I also want to note here, I think when people look at where the money for think tanks is coming from, sometimes people will then jump to the conclusion, this person works for that think tank. This expert is compromised, and we should just ignore all their scholarship, which I think is also the wrong take. I don't think it's that simple. Maybe you could explain more, though.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right, and this is another area for me that reminds me of the model of Farah, in that when we're talking about think tank funding, we're not saying that you shouldn't take. I've never said to anyone you know you shouldn't take that funding. You know, I might make exceptions for people. You know, the Mohammed bin Salmans of the world. You know, I think maybe don't take money from that guy. But the issue for me, I don't think is about it's not playing judge or it's not playing like scorekeeper. The issue with think tanks is about transparency. And it's just about being open and honest with people about where you're getting your funding, and then being open and honest about any conflicts of interest or potential conflicts of interest, I think is the issue. The problem I have is when folks try to hide these relationships, or, you know, they bury their funders somewhere on their website, and you know, they're not open and honest about it. I think those are the more worrisome cases when you try to keep these relationships from people. You know, if you're open and honest and you come out and you say, you know, I get funding from so-and-so, and I'm going to talk about an issue that's very important to them, but, you know, I'm going to let you know ahead of time that, you know, it's my potential bias. I'm not necessarily going to discount that what somebody says just because of their funding. But I want to know that so I have a full picture of where what I'm hearing.
I was going to add to that. I think Quincy is probably a really good example of that, actually, because, you know, they're pretty open about having gotten funding from the Kochs and George Soros. And, you know, I think that's perfectly fine.
Yeah, and it's one of my favorite things to do too. Is that I too am in the exact same boat, and actually my very first funder at the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative was the Charles Koch Foundation. And now, who continues to support my program, but now my biggest funder at FITI is the Open Society Foundation, George Soros' organization. So I too, I'm in that exact same boat. And if you ask folks, you ask your friends on the right, they're, I can't believe you take that Soros money. And then, I go to my friends on the left and they say, well, I can't believe you take that Coke money. But I actually, it's important. And I list this in all my reports. All of our funders are listed in all the reports that we put out. If anybody provided support to that report, they're listed front and center in the acknowledgments. And so, we put it right in the products that we're producing. So folks know exactly what's up with us. And even specific to that product, because I want people to know, if you want to judge this as a Soros thing or a Coke thing, I'm going to put it right in there that, hey, it's both. And then people can judge it accordingly. And I actually think, and in both Quincy's defense and my defense on this, I think this is good, and that we actually need to find where you have these Venn diagrams that people think of as their boogeyman. Where do they overlap? Like where can we agree? And the one big area where Camp Soros and Camp Koch agree is that having a less militarized foreign policy and having a more peaceful, less militaristic foreign policy. And if that's an area that they can agree on, that's fortunately an area for me where I've already been doing, for years have been doing research. And so to have them come together to support that type of work and support places like Quincy too, I think is incredibly valuable. And it's something that I don't think we should revile. I think we should seek out more areas where we can get agreement from these ideologically, seemingly extreme voices.
So in regards to the think tank issue, then, I think you may have just given us a few answers, but what's the main things that can be done to maybe restore trust in think tanks in D.C., and why should we seek to restore that trust? Because I think some people may ask that.
I'll tackle the last question first, because it's one of the it's a great question, and it was one of the biggest things that folks asked us when we told them we were tackling this project. Why should we care what people think about think tanks? And even some of the responses we've had to the report, people are saying things like, "Who the heck cares what the American public thinks about think tanks?" And I really reject that notion, and it's because I think if you accept that notion that we should not care what people think about think tanks, then you're also implicitly accepting the notion that we shouldn't care that the American public doesn't trust their government. Because think tanks, for better or for worse, they're like quasi policymakers. They're providing a lot of the ideas that Congress has. They're literally writing speeches for members of Congress, and in some cases, literally writing legislation that members of Congress introduce. And so if we let those organizations who are doing that high level, literally writing the laws of the nation, if we let them remain untrusted, then the American public is only going to continue to trust its government less and less and less and less. And if those think tanks continue to be seen as, shady dealers and, filled with dark money and elitist and only representing the interests of the rich and powerful, then that really hurts democracy just because think tanks have such powerful influence. And so that's really why we wanted to tackle this issue of, like, how do we get better trust in think tanks? And so for us, to that question, JG, we have a kind of big three recommendations. And number one is we want think tanks to have full financial transparency, be completely open and honest about who is funding the work that you're doing, be honest about how much they're funding it to, and if they're funding specific projects, be open and honest in those specific projects exactly what funding is coming in for that specific work. And then number two, and sort of related to that, we want think tanks to be proactive about conflicts of interest and even the appearance of conflicts of interest. And so if you're a think tank and you produce a report, say, on peace on the Korean Peninsula, and you're getting funding to do that work by the government of South Korea, Your readers have a right to know that. And we're encouraging think tanks to put that type of information front and center in that report or that op-ed or whatever it is. So their reader knows, and you know, they can judge it accordingly, good, bad, or ugly, be completely transparent about it. And then three, the third one, is that in all too many cases, we believe that think tanks are doing work that would constitute the necessity to register under the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Think tanks have become, in many cases, kind of lobbying shops and PR shops, where they're doing work on behalf of their funders that if the funder gave that money to one of the big lobbying firms around town, they'd be doing the exact same work that the think tank is doing. And so if that money is coming in from a foreign government to a think tank, and then that think tank is then spinning a yarn on behalf of that foreign power, that think tank should be registered under FARA and should be fully transparent about that work that they're doing on behalf of that foreign power.
Now, I know we only have, you know, maybe 10 or so minutes left, but I wanted to cover at least briefly the Taiwan lobby, because I don't think most people are aware of it, and I know you recently wrote a report on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and for us, it was one of those things where it was another one of my reports where when we first started doing it, people were like, why Taiwan? You know, why would you care about Taiwan? Because, you know, we're known for studying, you know, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, these Middle East monarchies. So people were like, why Taiwan? You know, it's democracy, U.S. ally. You know, what are they doing that the American public should care about? But the thing about Taiwan, and the reason I think people should know about it, it's not the biggest lobbying operation either. It's just a few million dollars a year. But Taiwan does a lot. They fund a number of think tanks around town, number one, and they fund a number of lobbying and PR firms around town too. And Taiwan is very focused. They do some business lobbying and stuff like that, economic related things, but they're just overwhelmingly focused on China and on U.S. foreign U.S. militarization of U.S. foreign policy in the Asia Pacific. And they, along with Japan and South Korea and some other U.S. allies there, have a very, very vested interest in keeping the U.S. As forward deployed as possible in the Asia Pacific and really keeping the U.S. On kind of this war footing with China. And so in producing that report on Taiwan, our goal was to just make people aware of this and the extent to which they are lobbying. They are lobbying for this issue, and they're lobbying for their interests at the end of the day. I think we can have a good debate about what the proper role for the U.S. military is in the Asia Pacific. But what we wanted to do is to show that Taiwan is sort of tipping the scales on this, and they're tipping the scales in U.S. foreign policy debates about the region in favor of a more militarized U.S. foreign policy there, in favor of continued U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. And so for us, allowing people to know that, I think it helps to give you a cleaner lens for viewing the debate about what the U.S. military presence should be in the Asia Pacific.
So just so people aren't confused, it's true that the Taiwan lobby is actually called the China lobby, right?
No. Okay. I mean, Taiwan is an incredibly interesting case, right? You know, because we don't officially recognize Taiwan as a country, you know, variously referred to as the island of Taiwan or things of that nature. And so Taiwan actually doesn't have a formal embassy in the U.S. They have an organization, it's called TECRO. It's like Taiwan Economic and Cultural and Regional Office, I believe. I might have butchered the acronym there. But it's this sort of, you know, not embassy, but quasi-embassy-like institution that Taiwan runs. And so, it's not connected with China, you know, and Taiwan is very much has this adversarial relationship with China, and there's this sort of, you know, constant threat if you're Taiwan of China launching missiles at this small little island, or, you know, hitting it with planes, Chinese naval power, that sort of thing. So there is a big difference there, but it is separate from China's much more expansive influence operation.
Yeah, I ask because I know sometimes people will say the China lobby when they're talking about Taiwan lobbying efforts.
Yeah. I've heard that too, and I think that's a mistake, frankly. And also we can get into China too. We have a report, hopefully coming out later this year, on China's influence in America. But China takes a very different approach than Taiwan does, and sort of out of necessity. You know, Taiwan is a U.S. ally, and so when a lobbyist for Taiwan contacts a congressional office, chances are they're going to be very well received. You know, members of Congress, they're more likely to get meetings and more likely to have folks on the Hill agree with them. China's a very different story. China, for better or worse, has become something of a boogeyman on the Hill in America writ large right now. And so China takes a very different approach to influence. So I think it's a mistake to talk about the China lobby when talking about Taiwan.
So before we conclude here, what would you say are the biggest or most influential of these foreign lobbies and also just of think tanks in D.C.?
Oh man, this is a great question.
I'm always a names person.
No, and I've got no qualms with it either. We were just talking about China, and so you know, at least by the numbers now, China is the number one spender on FARA registered lobbying and public relations firms. They've in fact increased their spending fivefold in just the last 4 years. So just this immense increase in spending. So if you're just looking at the dollars and cents, you know, China's number one. But I think that's a poor way to look at it. If you're talking about just pure raw influence on U.S. foreign policy, there's no way China's number one. And there's a reason that they're spending that much money is that they're not effective at influence in America. A lot of the money that they're spending on is going to media outlets that frankly nobody in America reads or nobody in America watches. Then the media programs that they have here, you know, it's hard to find anybody in the DC community or even my friends here down in Florida where I live now. If you ask them if they've read the China Daily, they're like, the what? It was like, well, it's the Chinese newspaper that they send around in the U.S. Nobody reads this crap. So while China may be number one, I don't think they're number one in terms of actual influence. And for that, the sort of standard bearers for influence, the long time top spenders have been countries like Japan and South Korea. We're pretty much year in and year out, Japan and South Korea were sort of one and two in terms of influence. But then that leaves out, I'm going to keep arguing with myself and say, so that leaves out, of course, the granddaddy of them all, the Israel lobby. And now the Israel lobby historically hasn't been a big spender under FARA. And a big reason for that is the crux of the Israel lobby's influence, the AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, is not registered under FARA, and that's because it is run by U.S. citizens, and it's not connected, or at least ostensibly, is not connected with the government of Israel, and so therefore hasn't had to register under FARA historically. That said, if you count AIPAC into this mix, then it's hard to say that the Israel lobby is not the most influential lobby in America, I think. And I would actually follow that with the Gulf monarchies, which I spend a lot of time looking at, Saudi Arabia and the UAE. The UAE, for your listeners who haven't heard of a guy named Ambassador Otaiba, who is the UAE's ambassador to the U.S., this guy is like an ambassador slash playboy slash party host. Exposés on him are just incredible. And as multiple people have said to me when I was doing my UAE report, that Otaiba throws the best parties in the city. And so he's another form of influence where the UAE historically hasn't spent a lot on lobbying operations. And part of the reason is they haven't had to, because they've had this incredibly effective and influential ambassador who's been able to get a lot done for them kind of on the cheap. So those are, I think that's my top five, top, maybe six, if you count China in there. So China, Israel, South Korea, Japan, and then Saudi and UAE too, I think are my top six in some sort of order.
Yeah, and I would just add to that. I know people that try to argue over what order they should put in, particularly between Israel and Saudi Arabia. I always hear the argument, who has more influence? And I mean, to me, it's like, you know, all of these operations seem to be about influence. I think they all wield a lot of influence or try to. So does it really matter which one exactly is at the top of the heap?
Right. I completely agree with that, JJ. And I think also it's, you know, if you're going to answer that question, you got to say, like, what day is it? Oh, it's Tuesday. You know, that's Israel. You know, tomorrow it could be the Saudis and then the Chinese. And then, you know, there's definitely an ebb and flow with all of this.
So in closing, I just wanted to get your opinion on this issue with the defense budget. I think the Pentagon's requesting, I think, over $700 billion. What do you think about the age-old argument people make of, you know, we need to have a strong defense in America. So, you know, we need to give as much money to the military as possible.
I really think that COVID, this whole pandemic experience has put the lie to that statement, has put the lie to the war hawks, in that people have heard the comparisons now probably more times than they would care to about the size of the CDC budget versus the size of the Department of Defense's budget. In which one has cost more American lives, right? We're in no danger of getting invaded anytime soon. We have these giant, wonderful oceans surrounding us and keeping our enemies largely at bay. And yet, still in Joe Biden's defense budget, the F-35 program, one of the worst military programs in U.S. history, that program alone is getting more funding than the entirety of the CDC, which is responsible for responding to this global pandemic that we're crawling out of. So I think that's absurd that we still have just one single weapon at DOD that is getting more money than the Centers for Disease Control, which hopefully will help to prevent the next pandemic from happening.
It's interesting, too, because I think there could be transpartisan agreement on this very specific issue of the defense budget, because I know people will say, oh, Republicans want a strong defense budget. But I think there's a lot of conservatives that, you know, think, no, we should have, you know, more conservation. This is my tax money. And I think a lot of Democrats, especially at the grassroots level, don't really like war. And I actually think Americans in general probably don't like war that much. I think what we're talking about here, questioning the defense budget, could get a lot of support.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, people tend to think of this as a partisan issue. But, you know, whenever I talk to any of my Republican friends, you know, both in D.C. and outside of it, when these issues come up, you know, if you're a Republican, you want a strong defense, but you don't like paying taxes. You know, my good conservative friends, you know, they're the people who are just as upset on tax day as I am, frankly. You know, I don't want higher taxes either. And so, you know, if we can lower that defense budget a little bit and, you know, pay a little less taxes, you know, I think you get that conservative support. And I also think, too, you know, even my conservative friends, just seeing what's happened over the past year and just how woefully unprepared we were to to respond to something like a pandemic, I think that really put it in perspective for people. And I would just say a shameless plug for something I co-authored with my wonderful colleague Bill Hartung a few years ago. It's called the Sustainable Defense Task Force Report. And you can find it at our website, internationalpolicy.org. And amongst them, we got together kind of a who's who of former members of the administration, Republicans, Democrats, this big group of a dozen people from across the ideological spectrum. We said, all right, if we were going to cut the defense budget, how would we do it and why would we do it? And to our, I don't know if we had our miss, somebody called Miss Cleo and got the crystal ball out. One of the reasons that we said we needed to do it is because we needed to focus on other threats like global pandemics. This was before COVID. And so when COVID happened, we were basically like, we told you we were unprepared. why would we still continue to make these mistakes?
And I just wanted to add to that. If you're into progressive politics, I think you have to think about things like foreign policy at this point, especially if you're a progressive that, say, supports something like Medicare for All. I've even seen progressives more lately talk about, maybe we should have federal jobs guarantees. And regardless of what we think of those issues, you can't have those things if you have so much spending on the defense budget.
Right. And another thing, I'll tack on to your tack on. If you were in progressive politics and you were at any of the Black Lives Matter protests over the summer, that chances are you saw military equipment. Chances are, you saw the police using a Hummer. You saw the police using an MRAP. You saw these big military guns and, other equipment. And the reason for that, the military has a specific program to provide military equipment to local police forces too. So even if you don't care about the dollars and cents, you only care about domestic policy, foreign policy is becoming domestic policy because of programs like this.
Well, hey, Ben, we could go on for another hour probably, but I know you're busy. So I want to let you get going, but how can my listeners keep up with your work and the great work that everyone is doing, not just at the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative, but also just the Center for International Policy in general?
Yeah. Please check us out at our website, www.internationalpolicy.org. You can find all our programs there. We have my program. We have a program called the Security Assistance Monitor that has all of this information on U.S. arms sales, security assistance abroad. We have my colleague Bill Hartung, who is one of the best and the leading voices in progressive foreign policy. Just a wonderful, brilliant person on really all these issues we've talked about.
I need to get Bill on the show at some point.
You've got to get him. Bill is just one. Wonderful. So definitely follow Bill. We're also all on Twitter too. I'm on Twitter at Ben Freeman DC. My program is on Twitter at Influence Watch. Bill Hartung, I forget Bill Hartung. I think it's at William Hartung. He's on there too. And at International Policy is our overall, our big handle too. So please follow us. Tune in, email us, let us know what you think about this stuff. We're always looking for feedback. If you got some extra money lying around, throw a donation our way too. We are woefully underfunded and we're fighting the biggest and the best funded. So any support you can provide, whether it's a pat on the back with an email or a retweet or a little cash, we would just greatly appreciate it.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Ben Freeman. If you're interested in checking out more of his work, then visit him at the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative at the Center for International Policy. It's a great website and a great resource, and I highly recommend looking into some of the papers that have been released as part of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Brian, Rats, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.